Welcome to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is game week, Thursday, September 3rd. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, John Bryce, USA Today, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, the Thursday crew, ready to preview the next, is it 12 or 16 games? 15 games, is that possible as well, guys? But we'll start with number one, Wisconsin. We'll get to the Badgers soon. We did speak with coordinators Chris Ash, Mike Denbrock, and Marty Biaggi last night. Tim, I'll throw it to you. You made your way around to at least the offensive defensive coordinators, I know. What were kind of your main takeaways there?
Yeah, this is something we, for those of the people that saw our incident analysis with myself and Drew Mentak, something I hit on last night. But, you know, just listening to, you know, I think it's always interesting to hear a defensive coordinator's perspective on your quarterback, on CJ Carr. And he just talked about, you know, he'll show up at the, Ash will show up at the facility in the morning and Carr will already be there. And it's about understanding defensive tendencies. There's no doubt that CJ Carr knows the Notre Dame offense inside and out, but it's understanding coverages and tells and body language and, you know, where a DB is pointed, where his feet are pointed, all those kind of things that CJ Carr takes into consideration, which, you know, as Ash said, you know, most guys are just trying to learn the offense, let alone understand exactly what the opposition is doing. And CJ Carr does a great job at that. And then the other thing would be Mike Denbrock talking about the catch 22. I know we're going to get into Luke Fickell's comments about throwing to Leonard Moore's side. And Denbrock was diplomatic about it and said that, you know, you have to strike a balance. It's a bit of a catch 22. Nobody likes to play with half the field, which is what Fickell mentioned. So you have to find a balance there. And I would imagine that, you know, I don't think Luke Fickell and Wisconsin are going to target Leonard Moore seven times like Stanford did. That just wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. But they do have to go to that side of the field and see if they can scheme something up against Leonard Moore.
Pete, that was your line of questioning with Denbrock because of your story you wrote or came out yesterday, I believe, on CJ Carr. I had a feel you might be writing about CJ Carr, some of the questions over the course of this camp is going on.
Intriguing, Pete. You did a great job asking questions last night, Pete.
I appreciate that.
I stole all your answers.
Yeah, right there.
I appreciate that.
I should have gone to Pete first. Sorry, go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, well, I mean, my story on CJ Carr was about him as a philosophy major, so I actually did not have to do with his pre-snap reads.
Snap reads.
But there's, I mean, look, there's just a lot of interesting things about CJ Carr. At, you know, coming into a year with so much expectation, sort of how he adjusts, how he works, and just sort of how he sees football in general, I think is just so interesting. I think, I don't know who asked him about, like, his leadership style, because it, my antenna went up when Marcus Freeman, I think it was after the jersey scrimmage or camp scrimmage, he was just like, you know, hey, as a leader, sometimes you got to put your arm around a guy. You don't say that unless you've seen CJ Carr do the opposite. And I feel like that is actually probably more Carr's leadership style. Like, after another quarterback with some Michigan roots who is, you know, incredibly exacting, which is why he's won so many Super Bowls. Like, that's, I think CJ Carr is like, he's not going to screw around. You know, he's not, there's no like flower language with him. He's not going to be all like verbose in his praise of players, like to us maybe, but not, you know, I think when he's out there and just sort of how he sees football is, I think, incredibly interesting, not just like from a football point of view, but from a philosophical point of view. So that was kind of the crux of my story in The Athletic yesterday.
I talked to Chris Ash, or I didn't ask Chris Ash this question, but I'm glad it was asked at the very end of his segment. He was asked about Luke Fickell's comments about going at Leonard Moore. And Chris Ash is about as diplomatic and plain as a... I thought he gave a really good interview last night, but Chris Ash does not go on a limb much. And his response was actually, I mean, and this is the tone, well, they have a game plan. They have to execute it. Good luck to them.
That's exactly what
it's legitimately funny.
It's actually pretty good time, so he pulled that one out. So, no, I asked Ash something I wanted to ask him this, JB, from the first practice. I think I told you this. Do you ever consider, because he has all the defensive tackle rotations and things going, and we're trying to figure out Mukum, and he was praised Mukum again. Do you concern yourself with how they play together? Like, do Mukum and Onye play together better than Mukum and Brew, or Brew and Gray, or is Gray and Onye? And he said it's part of it. Part of it is, and I never would have guessed this one, maybe one of them has to be next to a good communicator. You just don't think of that. And he pointed out, he said, the defensive line communication is much more than everyone else. So I thought that was an interesting take. And then he also threw in, well, the best players play, and some guys have to be able to play nose and three technique. That I think we all could have guessed that from watching a lot of football. But when he said you got to be next to a communicator, I just never would have thought that. You say that all the time at like center, guard, tackle on the offense. You don't think of that at defensive tackle.
I was literally about to say you don't typically get that kind of insight from Ash or very many defensive coordinators, to be honest with you. And we all think about and have all talked about how vital communication is along the offensive line. But that's some great insight there from Chris Ash into how they're approaching their defensive tackle rotation. As you kind of noted, he's not the most loquacious person all of the time, but he is fun to talk with. And one thing I wanted to share with CJ Carr, Pete's great story, is one that I learned about this summer that either came from spring or I think last year's preseason camp. And I was told this is when CJ Carr really started to get the respect of his teammates as a true and natural, but also alpha leader. And I'm told during a particularly chippy, chirpy practice, and they'd just been going at it the entire day. I mean, the kind of practices that Marcus Freeman really likes, but now does a better job of sort of managing and moderating out on the practice field. They're in the red zone, and CJ Carr runs a naked boot, basically, and walks into the end zone while there's this massive crush of humanity behind him because they've been on the fake so well. And the defense realized what's happened. And again, they've been talking trash all day long. And I was told that CJ Carr pointed at every single one of the defenders and went, screw you, screw you, screw you, screw you. All through every single defensive person on the field, CJ Carr turned around and gave them a screw you while, and it was not that
screw you. That's, he said, screw you?
Yeah. while being, as his teammates came to mob him. So yep. I meant to share that one just a couple of weeks ago. Your all's discussion on CJ Carr this morning made me realize that I had absolutely had to share it today. It was no fluke play. He didn't score on a flea flicker or anything. He just flat out deked the entire defense and walked into the end zone, Pete.
I was going to say, the thing that I wanted to get into Denbrock about yesterday was short yardage. And I sort of led into that with like, all right, you got Cooper Flanagan. And I phrased the question like, no disrespect to Eli Raritan, but you know, does Flanagan and Flanagan give you like a more of an edge, like a physical edge on, you know, the edge of your offensive line? Is that a solution for short yardage? And he's like, you know, it's not the whole thing, but it's part of it. And then he volunteered, you know, after doing an extensive self-scout and figuring out, okay, what works, what doesn't, throw out the stuff that doesn't, let's drill down on what works. Like, Chris Ash's defense has thrown everything at them during camp, and Denbrock said, like, they haven't stopped us in short yardage yet. And I know that some people are like, well, wait a minute. Like, is that bad news for the defense? Like, I think the defense will be fine. I also don't think the defense is going to face a lot of short yardage until mid-October. But if that's true, if Notre Dame has had this sort of riddle of last season solved, then that would sort of change how I feel about the offense, because they were terrible in that scenario last year. And Denbrock is up there 3 days before the game saying, like, we got this figured out.
It's funny, Pete, you said people have jumped to, well, the defense has a problem. Actually, one of the questions I was answering, I was on the Wisconsin Badger 24/7, and someone said, are Notre Dame fans concerned about the size differential? I'm like, you know, is there one? You know, he's like, oh yeah, the offensive line's huge, your defensive line, you know, 300 under. And I'm thinking to myself, they're thinking like, this is old days, single wing, got a pancake block, Notre Dame to oblivion. And I just like, I don't think that's an issue. I mean, I think one issue could be, we'll get into the issues later on, but it's funny you bring that up, Pete, because we had a lot of questions about third and short. And the answer I'm going to come up with is the firm of Flanagan and Flanagan.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The law firm of Flanagan and Flanagan.
That's the differentiator right now. One more differentiator. We did speak with the other three captains along with CJ Carr. Adon Shuler confirmed he will play after the passing of his father, Don. And then Jordan Faison, I have a question for you, Priester, because it was on the board and you wrote a story about this. From Trent McNear, T. McNear, Jordan Faison has gone from walk-on to captain. Has that happened before? We know it has, but I'm going to let you explain them.
Yeah, he's the fifth former walk-on that has, you know, earned a scholarship and then been named a captain. Now, Austin Webster is the lone walk-on that was named a captain while still a walk-on. But the first one was Shane Walton, who was a great cornerback in the early 2000s, Joe Schmidt. course, 2015. That's kind of cheating because I think we knew he was going to be put on scholarship at some point. But he did come in as a walk-on, and then I mentioned Webster. And Chris Fink was one of the captains of the 2022 team. So it's not unprecedented, certainly. And to even think of Jordan Faison as a walk-on or a former walk-on now, it's almost, you know, it isn't something that comes to mind because he's Notre Dame's best pass receiver right now.
I thought it was interesting, like he said, he was surprised. Because I think whenever someone is named a captain, we're like, yeah, I've been gunning for this for 3 years. And he's like, no, I was surprised. And I wasn't even thinking about it until Lauren Landau mentioned it to me.
Well, so he mentioned to me about Lando saying it to him. And it's like, you know, Lando saying, dude, these guys respect you. You're a leader. And I think that's when he started realizing that, you know, that he could be a captain too. But no, it's rare. It should be rare. But you know, Jordan Faison's a pretty rare football player in
the history. That's good info. So when Matt Jeffrey's a captain in 2 years, we'll remember.
Yeah, could be
explosion or the implosion of message boards everywhere. Unless he's become the next Jordan Faison, which he exactly would be because he was a lacrosse walk on, so he would literally be the next Jordan Faison. Tim Priester, it's time we get to preview a football game. First time since it must have been about November 23rd last year we previewed a Notre Dame football game. Irish are 20.5-point favorites over Wisconsin. That thing has held. I didn't look this morning, actually, unfortunately. But that thing has held as of last night since the original line came out in June as part of the games of the year. 47.5 is the over-under. I will get to how I feel about that later. But I wanted to lead with the Leonard Moore part because one of our good friends, Very Piratey, has a funny conversation for us to start with. What's the worst strategy against the Notre Dame secondary? Throwing at Leonard Moore or starting Graham Mertz?
What were their options?
Jamie?
You have an answer. I'm glad. When I first saw that just 30 minutes ago, I was cracking up. So I'll give the floor to you guys.
Both are detrimental to the Badgers.
They both result in interceptions is what happens.
Yes, exactly.
That's exactly what I was going to say, darn it. So.
Allowing your verbal talent to come out, John Bryce. There is no... Go ahead, Tim Priester. I start with Colton Joseph, obviously, is where we start.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, their starting quarterback has been injured the last 3 years. Last year's starting quarterback, who's now the starting quarterback in North Carolina, was injured in the second quarter of game one against Miami, Ohio. So, you know, they need health there. And I don't think there's any doubt that Colton Joseph is the best pass-run combination that they've had during these 4 years, but he does, you know, last year against the Sun Belt Conference, he threw an interception every 29 passes, which isn't a great ratio. So I expect him to put it up for grabs at least a few times. I just think that that's his nature. And plus, if you look at his film, I mean, he's a career under 60% passer, and it's because he's just not that accurate. He's a dynamic player, really a dynamic athlete, a quarterback, but he can throw it around a little bit. And then I actually haven't seen the responses to my Thursday thoughts, but I'm sure it's because I have so many people telling me that Notre Dame's going to destroy Wisconsin. And Wisconsin's not Purdue. This is a winning program. This is a program that's used to winning. They won big time under Barry Alvarez. They won 10 games a year under Brett Bielema. Gary Anderson was the head coach for 2 years. They won 20 games. And Paul Chryst was fired after winning 61 games in the 6 complete years that he coached. This is a winning program. This isn't Purdue. It's not Northwestern. And it's a team that's physical and stops the run. They held Indiana to 2.2 yards per carry last year. And Ohio State, they limited. So I just the perception of what Wisconsin is because of 4-8 last year and the injuries at quarterback, I just don't think is an accurate depiction of the Wisconsin program. It's a solid program that's physical, and Notre Dame needs to come ready to play.
I don't think I wouldn't care if they started Count Chocula at quarterback this week. The fact of the matter is, when facing this question, Wisconsin's not good enough on offense, in my opinion, to not occasionally try to throw the football at Leonard Moore. Like, Wisconsin is going to have to take some risks in this contest, TP, in order to get the ball down the field against Notre Dame. They're not going to be able, in my opinion, we'll see Sunday, to sustain drives enough to give their offense chances to score points while keeping Notre Dame's offense off the field. That's obviously Wisconsin's best path to what would be a monumental upset. And T.O., I checked while we were looking here. It's held at 20.5 everywhere except the Hard Rock Casino has it at 21.5. And so anyway, people are very bullish on the Irish.
Big point. That's a big point, John Price.
That half is no joke. Somebody was asking me about it. Like I would think whatever the first half line is, I kind of like Wisconsin to cover that. I think the superior team pulls away over the balance of four quarters. But yeah, Wisconsin has about a $30 million roster from everyone I've spoken with in doing that story that we talked about last week. And they're invested in this season because they have to be. They've stuck by Luke Fickell. Everything rides on this season for the Badgers, and it starts Sunday evening.
And, you know, let me just throw this in here about the wide receiver core at Wisconsin. I mean, Notre Dame fans are wringing their hands about Notre Dame's wide receiver core. Wisconsin's isn't on the level of Notre Dame's, and I don't think that they've had a great camp. The Domingo kid that transferred from Southeast Louisiana, I don't think he's panned out at all. They have a transfer from Rigby from Oklahoma State and some leftovers. But like when you compare wide receiver cores, I think Notre Dame's is further along than what Wisconsin's is. And so, yeah, I agree with you, John. I think Colton Joseph could throw a few up for grabs, and Notre Dame would be happy to say thank you very much.
I think it's how you throw it, Leonard Moore. Like I would just limit myself to like throws behind the line of scrimmage, like stay screens essentially. And then a couple deep shots, that would be it. I would not throw a lot of like intermediate stuff at Leonard Moore. I think that's a waste of everyone's time. I mean, Leonard Moore gave up 3 receptions or on targets of 20 yards or more last year. You probably remember them. The Miami one was, we got beat on a double move. There's BC at the end of the half and Mekhi Lemon got him on an inside slant. Like there's no Mekhi Lemon on Wisconsin roster, obviously. So I think you can take the slant away, but I think you just got to be smart with it. Denbrock, I thought, came to Fickell's defense a little bit. It's like, look, I had to practice against Sauce Gardner when he was the head coach, and it's not any fun, but you can't just seed half of the field. Like, that's a waste of time. So I get where they're coming. I do think you got to be smart about how you're going at Leonard Moore. And then I guess I would run the ball at him a lot if I was Wisconsin. Like, they've got some bigger backs. Maybe leave Leonard Moore unblocked and just like pound it into him and see what you get. But yeah, I would, the sort of comeback route along the sideline for a 12-yard gain, like just scrap that. Don't take that out of the game plan.
Totally agree with that.
Everything outside the hash marks is out of bounds.
Absolutely. If you want to try slants against him, okay, he's had some moments where he hasn't succeeded. But Eddie, I totally agree with you guys. Anything outside the hash is a mistake. Throwing in Leonard Moore's direction.
Yeah, everyone should be fired if they throw back shoulder tape.
Oh, I mean, come on. Yeah, it's just the most ridiculous thing in the world. Just one more thing on the Wisconsin defense, because, you know, if you look at FEI, which is really the best way to sum up a team's season, and they did not have Colton Joseph, as Priester has pointed out, now, their defense was 25th in the country last year. Their offense was 99th or 100th in the country last year. So it's a disparity. They need to keep this game low scoring. I have a question. I think it's targeting you, Priester, because I am going to guess he read your first rate series from Full House Backfield. Mm-hmm. We've heard some praise for the Wisconsin linebackers. Where would they stack if they were in the Notre Dame linebacker room? In other words, what am I looking for? More broadly, how many stingy Wisconsin defenders would actually start on this defense?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously Notre Dame's linebacking core is very, very good. Mason Posa and Cooper Catalano are excellent football players. And they did it as true freshmen last year in like 9 combined starts. They're really good. They would belong in Notre Dame's linebacker room. Now, who would they beat out? You know, I don't necessarily think they would beat out Notre Dame starters there or even the top 3. I think Javon Robinson, who's a transfer from Arizona State, could have competed for a starting corner spot. Matthew Jung, their safety's pretty good, but he wouldn't have beaten out either one of Notre Dame's safety. So, I mean, if you look at it from that standpoint, no, there aren't going to be, you know, there may not be anybody from their starting lineup that would start for Notre Dame, but it's a program, it's a culture, and it's a collective, and they work pretty well together.
They have one player that was on the roster. Did you just mention Aaron Witt, TP? I apologize.
I did not.
Yeah, Aaron Witt, the linebacker who will start for them in this game, was actually on the Wisconsin roster in 2021, has had his career impeded a couple of years along the way due to injury, but he's played 21 games the past couple of years, started 10 of them. He's penciled in as a starter for the Badgers.
Did he beat out Kamara? Is that who he beat out?
I'm not sure who.
Because Kamara has some experience too. I mean, I meant to look to see where I had them rated in the first rate among linebackers, but I know I had them in the top three or four. It's a good group, but
yeah,
Notre Dame good.
Yeah, I don't see a player on that roster or at that position that would start for Notre Dame, but that's a very solid linebacker group that you know has been well mentored with Luke Fickell there. So
I want to point out they also are not – you had him fourth, Tim Priestry.
Just fourth, okay.
Google's our friend. I would like to point out they're also not going against Notre Dame's linebackers or stingy defense because they just have to be better than the guys in front of them. And we'll have plenty of questions about this game in segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We are back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question, Jim Booney, CRS. The following three areas have been discussed at length and maybe ad nauseum in this offseason. Boundary wide receiver, right guard, and nickel. Which one do you think we are overthinking? In other words, that position will be fine. And which one do you think will be the biggest pain point throughout the year? Pete Sampson, floor is yours.
I don't think nickel is even under consideration. Like, nickel is so far away from those other two for me. I think it's receiver, because I think you can kind of fake your way to have a good right guard, especially when you have a potentially great right tackle and a very good center and Will Black and Anthony Knapp on top of that. Plus, you can throw some tight ends in there and have the running backs help out too. I don't think there's a whole lot you can do to fake a mediocre receiver room. I'm not saying Notre Dame has a mediocre receiver room. I think they're a little bit better than that. But receiver, and look, they've got more than enough receiver talent to win 10 and a half games. I'm talking more about, like, all right, we're in December and January. Do you have enough to win those games? That's a bigger concern for me than right guard. And on top of that, like, maybe you have Matty Augustine back by then too. So you can throw more material at that position. So it's boundary receiver one, right guard two, nickel three.
JB.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this one doesn't require some sort of Jeffersonian deep thought philosophical approach to it. I completely agree with Pete. It's the boundary wide receiver position. Notre Dame feels really good about its offensive line, whether Prescott goes out first or whether it's Absher or whether both of them play like we saw at times last year at that position. And they feel like they've got pros anchoring the line at each end, as well as Anthony Knapp is going to be a pro as well. And so nickel, I'm not concerned about nickel. I think they have, again, I'll trot out the line until people get tired of it. They've got prospects instead of suspects there. So, and they like the abilities of their prospects. But for me, boundary receiver will be the concern until it's not a concern. The one thing I would say about the totality of Notre Dame's receiving core is, like, those guys should not stop getting better just because the season has arrived. So who they are and what they are this Sunday against Wisconsin better not be who they are and what they are October 17th at BYU.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think boundary receiver, you know, you have other options to throw to when, regardless who the boundary receiver is. At right guard, there's one right guard on field at a time. And at nickel, there's one nickel on the field at a time. And, you know, I mean, I think poor play. I think it's a good point, Pete, that, you know, you can cover up, you know, maybe one of the five offensive linemen that isn't necessarily efficient. But, you know, if there's a huge gap at that position, that can really screw up your running game. It can really screw up your pass pro. And then nickel can be a killer if you're not sound there. So I think boundary wide receiver is an easy choice, especially since, again, we continue to hear real positive things about Micah Gilbert. If that comes to fruition, then, you know, then problem solved until somebody else emerges there. Quincy Porter comes back, et cetera.
I'm going to cheat and say he forgot, instead of nickel, should have put backup quarterback, because that is the number one concern for Notre Dame coming to this. You don't practice screwed. And then we've said a hell of a lot of stuff about CJ Carr and how he's going to make everybody better. Teddy Girard or Noah Grubbs might be a really good quarterback someday. They are not going to come in and make Notre Dame's wide receivers better like CJ Carr is. Next question, Grumpy Leprechaun. This question is more for Mr. Bryce, as he is dialed into all things college football. How do you think the SEC lawsuit is going to go? Do you think the SEC will lose this?
Appreciate that. Grumpy. I'm a little bit grumpy at how much my summer has entailed covering the freaking courts and the legal systems and Brendan Sorsby and all that. I am super grateful for former Notre Dame track and field captain Ryan Regula, who began his playing career at Pittsburgh as a football player. I just talked to him yesterday about this case. He's a national attorney for a firm with offices in Phoenix and D.C., and he works with universities all across the country. He has been an invaluable resource for our coverage at USA Today. The SEC is very confident, I will say. They're in the courtroom. They're getting ready to go in the courtroom right now in Louisiana, or they may be. We're in all these different time zones, but the court, they're in court today in Louisiana. The SEC is pretty confident. The NCAA seems relatively confident as well. The NCAA got another win yesterday in West Virginia. This one hasn't been reported about too terribly much because the written decision from the judge has not arrived there just yet. But 14 plaintiffs, Trotter versus NCAA. The NCAA got the stay, got the verdict that they needed yesterday, at least initially from the judge. The other thing to stress, as I wrote, I think the story went live this morning at USA Today to kind of set up today's legal proceedings, is that the SEC is absolutely and very publicly saying, of course, we're not going to get a contempt of court order. We're not going to defy this judge. But let me remind you, 16 members, that at any point in time that we find a judge that sides with us, we will turn around and hammer your ass with penalties. And we will absolutely be merciless in doing so. And that's when I would remind you that the penalties can include a suspension of up to 50% of games for that coach. And if they're more than 50% through the season, then it's my understanding they could carry over into next year. The penalties can include up to 50% of a respective sports operating budget, and SEC operating football budgets are nine figures. And so that's a hefty fine that teams say they don't have enough to make their payroll for rev share and NIL. They sure can't take a 50% fine. And then on top of that, they can revoke your voting privileges, which means if you're the offending party and the SEC is voting on something important, your voice isn't going to be heard. And maybe that vote is going to be about how to further sanction you. So the SEC is very confident. Tom Mars is a brilliant legal expert. He is incredibly confident that the SEC is going to prevail. And one other thing to note, and we saw this, I guess, last year for Notre Dame, so it kind of ties in terms of submitting rosters, because Notre Dame, with its kicking issues last year, kept getting asked, why don't you go get somebody from the soccer team? There's people out there drilling field goals. Well, the roster you submit Friday, let's say you play Saturday, or for Notre Dame has to have its roster to the CAPS system, CAPS, by 5 p.m. Saturday. They might submit it Friday by 5 p.m. They have until 5 p.m. Saturday, 24 hours before your first game. If you submit a roster with 105 players on it, you're done at that point. You cannot add another player the rest of the season. If you submit a roster with 101 players on it, you can add four more players if you resubmit the roster moving forward, but they also have to like carry the designated student athlete label and all of this. So I just bring that into the equation because we've got the court case today and LSU has to submit a roster by tomorrow. And I suspect even if those guys are on the roster, we will not see them play this weekend.
Pete Sampson, this is the only time in our lives we'll be checking to see if the roster made it to the scholarship limit after 25 years of laughing at a message board, because LSU, if they have 101, will be pretty funny, actually. We'll know what's going on there. You're up, JB.
Question number three from our good friend Wash ND. CJ Carr seemed to let it slip in the press conference that Styles Prescott is the starting right guard. Are you concerned with the switch this late in camp, not only from tackle to guard, but left to right? A late line switch didn't work in 2024 with Sam Pendleton, but it did eventually work last year with Gerby Lambert, although game one was a bit rough. Tim O'Malley, you're the typical questioner, so we will defer to you and give you the floor right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking to nitpick this game from a Notre Dame standpoint, Styles Prescott was probably your fifth choice at right guard behind Charles Jagusa, Matty Augustine. I would have thought Sullivan Absher, he beat him out, but let's pretend that this, you know, we never thought that was happening. Chris Tarrick and backup left tackle Styles Prescott. So if you're going to nitpick something, this is the thing to nitpick. That's a tough.
What is our sense for the severity of the left, I presume, elbow with Absher, with Absher?
I don't know. Drew, the first time we knew about that, Drew saw an elbow brace, and it was August 25th. So we hadn't seen them in a while. But either way, if it's Styles Prescott, and it truly sounds like this, you don't read off your five linemen as a quarterback and put in Styles. Yeah. And I think it's Sullivan. But
I mean, if Prescott starts and takes control of the position, it's a really an incredible story, because I think I mentioned this in a recent podcast. I mean, early on in his time at Notre Dame, there was not a whole lot of optimism that I'm aware of in his future at Notre Dame. So God bless him. I mean, I think the praise of what he's done has been legitimate from Joe Rudolph, but we're also talking about an offensive line that, you know, it's, I don't want to say national title or bust, but this is a program with national title aspirations. And Prescott has not played a meaningful down, and now he will be thrust in there. So surprised that Absher didn't hold it down. That's why I ask the severity of the injury, because I thought he did enough last year in the five games that he started to warrant remaining the starter, as long as the injured players that you mentioned, Tim, are not available. But hey, Armel Mukum took a step up. It sounds like Styles Prescott's taken a step up too.
You guys, I kind of don't equate it to Mukum, though, because Mukum beat out five healthy players.
No, that's fair.
Yeah, I think there's position battles where you just sort of won by attrition, and there's position battles where you just hawked down a guy and just ran Reeled past him. In. Prescott feels more attrition to me. Mukum, Mukum is super impressive because they beat out two guys they paid a lot of money to get. That's different. So, you know, will they be fine with Prescott against Wisconsin? I would think so. I think they'll be fine with Prescott for a while if he's the guy. They can make that work. Like, I'm not saying he's as good as Anthony Knapp, but like, they started Anthony Knapp at Kyle Field as a true freshman. Like, I would think that Styles Prescott is a third year player. That's sort of an offensive lineman. That's a verdict year for them. So I think Styles Prescott in some ways is like right on schedule as a regular prospect, not a Joe Alt, Anthony Knapp prospect, to see what we got.
Question number four from Terry Benedict. Anthony Tresh seems to be Marcus Freeman's right-hand man to go to in operations based upon statistics and game situations. Can you see his role expanding this year? And can you see the football strategy department expanding?
Yes and yes. Marcus Freeman and Anthony Tresh meet multiple times per week. That's in the season, but they meet a lot out of the season as well. And so I think that that's significant. And I think that Marcus really trusts Tresh. And I think that he's got a big role and he will continue to be leaned upon. I've talked to a number of people, and I think that expanding that department is a real thing. There are more places talking about adding a director of AI strategy into their departments as well. It's already happened in a couple of spots, and it's going to continue to happen throughout the sport as well. That was a big topic of discussion last month at the College Football Personnel and Recruiting Symposium in Nashville, was AI in the space and how many programs are doing it. And I can tell you there's one of Notre Dame's bitter rivals that's actively discussing adding that same director of AI strategy position into their analytics department right now.
Well, JB, my question would be, how does that manifest itself? I mean, what does that mean? What would they do that would be more reliance upon statistics or statistical trends?
Well, I think if you had a director of AI, and this is, you know, all new to all of us, and I'll be the first to tell you, I'm no tech whiz, but I think if you have a director of AI, the belief is you can learn even more in a more compressed time in game prep on a week-to-week basis because of the adaptive technology. The AI will be able to pick up trends and help you learn so much more to an even greater depth about your opponent that week, as well as continuing to help you self-scout even more efficiently on a week-to-week basis.
I'll say this for Tresh. If Marcus Freeman was hired to the NFL last year, he would have brought Tresh with him to stand right behind him at those games, because that's how important he is. Pretty important, if you think of it that way. That guy was going with him.
I think that would even be more important for Marcus at that next level, because
yes.
Every game is Texas A&M and Miami so on and so forth. Like everything is on the margins there at, you know, here, do you need Anthony Tresh against Rice? Probably not. But, yeah. You know.
It'd be great if he wasn't there, Pete, if he just wasn't there for the Rice game because you said that. It's like, well, like, that took
he was just in the stands eating popcorn. Our Wall
Street Insider mentioned I didn't need to be here for the Rice game.
So, yeah. No. Taking the weekend off.
You guys got this. It's Tuesday afternoon and Tresh leaves just for a little while to go.
No, he could go sit in the stands at Spartan Stadium and see what he could catch from the sideline. Yeah,
that's right. Good call. He could scout there pretty well. All right. Next question. Great question. Also an incredible handle, and I'm glad I didn't accidentally lose it. From Looking for Friends. Now that we're into the season, the story of the 2024 season was the middle eight and the historic run Indy went on in that regard. But after Miami last year, the talk of the middle eight subsided quite a bit. What do you think was the reasoning for the drop-off, and will we see a return to middle eight dominance as a more prominent theme for 26? JB, you are a middle eight maven.
That he is.
I do love the middle eight, and I actually think I have Notre Dame's final 2024 middle eight stats handy, so I should just go ahead and
like get trash that right for here.
You. Yeah, 148-31 in the middle eight during that magical 2024 run. I think a couple of factors last year. Look, Notre Dame got started poorly in the middle eight. We saw Miami kind of have that advantage right from the outset, and then Notre Dame squandered some opportunities. Why was that last year? Look, I think you had a first-year starting quarterback who you didn't necessarily know from the outset how well he was going to command the offense, especially in those two-minute situations going into the half, and Marcus Freeman so often when he wins the coin toss to make sure that his team gets the ball to start the second half. You did not have a reliable kicking game on any sort of game in and game out basis last year. Yeah. And you had a new defensive coordinator. I think it was those three factors more than anything. I do think in speaking with people in the program, there's extreme confidence that they will recapture the 2024 dominance. It's still very much a point of emphasis for Notre Dame. Are they going to go 148-31 this year? Probably not, but I don't know if they'll give up 31 points in the middle eight of the regular season this year. And again, I don't have the numbers. Last year, they were not remotely as good, but I do think they feel great about Jasper. They feel really, really good about Spencer Porath, and they obviously feel incredibly well about CJ Carr.
I was going to say, like, Ash is important because he was kind of a culprit in the middle eight last year. I mean, the Purdue game was just ridiculous. But to have a kicker that you can count on, or like, hey, we're going to go down and try to like play the clock just perfectly here and kick a walk-off field goal going into the locker room, like, that's significant too. Notre Dame didn't have that last year. We saw that at Boston College in sort of a comical way. So to have that rectified, I think is significant.
Maybe Al Golden's better at halftime adjustments than Chris Ash. I mean, I don't know, but maybe that's the case.
I think this is also just like a regression of the mean. Like it's,
well, they were great.
Were lucky in 2024, but like they may have been a little bit lucky.
Yeah, no, I would lean more toward that because that's an outlier type season, no matter how much you emphasize middle eight.
Right. Yeah, all right. Maybe. Yeah, I know. Question number six, Troy Beachy. You know, that beach aroma is always nice. That's a good name. It's not quite the petrichor scent of a rain day. But anyway, going into last year, a lot was made of Chris Ash playing more zone coverage than Al Golden did. What is the percentage breakdown of what Indy defense played last year, zone versus man? And what do you expect those percentages to look like this year? So if any of you has the percentage breakdown of last year's coverage, I would invite you to take the floor first.
I do.
Peter Sampson does.
Yes, I do have that information.
I will fact check you. Go ahead.
Okay. So for last year, Notre Dame, they were fourth nationally in the amount of man schemes they played. I'm sorry, third nationally. Behind Utah and Colorado. So unfortunately, terrible Purdue has been removed from the equation here from previous years, which obviously means they were at the very bottom or near the bottom of zone coverage plays where they ranked 132nd. I would think they would probably be skewed that way again, which is a byproduct of Leonard Moore a lot and then Tae Johnson and Adon Shuler. So you can play a lot of man – with your Notre Dame, like What is Wisconsin going to throw a trick play? We're going to see like a hook and ladder or something to take advantage of this? Probably not. But I just think like, if you can play man and just bully somebody, do it. You don't need to get cute and play a bunch of funky zones.
I had him at 2% less man than the year before when they led the nation. So I have a feeling that there was the major drop off or the major zone schemes that Chris Ash was throwing out there wasn't the reason they lost games. It was 2% over the course of the year. Now,
look,
course,
I mean, the A&M game
might have been more against Miami and A&M.
Yeah, and A&M for sure. Yeah. They played a bunch of zone against A&M and they didn't know how to do it. Like, yeah. Tay Johnson was just a hot mess. Obviously got way, way better. But, and I'm not saying if they played man against A&M, they would have won because Leonard Moore was also hurt. But that was, I could be wrong here, but I would think that if you have a defense where communication isn't great, playing zone is going to look awful. Whereas playing man, you could be like, hey, we're just more talented than you, so we'll win. But, you know, their zone at the beginning of the year was bad.
Question number 7 is from Kay Beasley, and it is, name the receivers who get offensive snaps on Sunday and perhaps name the running backs you think will get a carry against Wisconsin.
I'll go first on the running backs. There'll be 3 people to get a carry.
So you get Kedron, Aeneas Williams, and Nolan James?
If he's healthy, yeah.
No freshman carries on Saturday.
I say not until, well, they'll do it against Rice. So if they were playing another Wisconsin on week 2, I think you'd see Jonas Walton at home getting in there too. But I think they've quite often really play it close to the vest. Like they play 17 or 18 guys on offense in these tough openers. I'll be wrong if they kill Wisconsin. Could be Jonas Walton then.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to blow Wisconsin away in such a like empty the bench fourth quarter kind of vibe. So I'm with you. I think it'll be just sort of, and look, they need to get Kedron Young and Nolan James carries.
Yeah.
Like we don't need to skip ahead to Jonas Walton at receiver. They need to get Mylon Graham work. And frankly, they probably need to get Matt Jeffrey work.
Yes.
Do we need to see Elijah Burris a whole lot? I mean, like maybe as the 6th guy. I mean, that was another line of questioning for me yesterday. I was just like, how many receivers is too many receivers?
That was my question. How did you go from camp mode to game mode with receivers? Because, and when I kind of said, I know the main 4, he immediately threw in, I need to get work with Mylon Graham. I was like,
oh, heck, I mean, they need work with Micah Gilbert.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. So yeah, I would think Sunday night would be a good night to just let the starters stay in longer and like the frontline guys stay in longer. When you get to Rice and Purdue, I mean, have at it. Let's see, you know, Jonas Walton. Let's get Devin Fitzgerald out there, but I don't need to see that on Sunday night against Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think the 5th would be a Matt Jeffrey at wide receiver. So, and if there's 6, maybe it's Devin Fitzgerald. Hard to say.
Jeffrey will play.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. But, and you know, you can trot a receiver. I mean, they just naturally rotate more at receiver than they do at running back. If there's a 4th running back to get a carry on Sunday, it'd be Jonas Walton. And I would not be surprised if he got 1 to 3 carries at some point in the game on Sunday, just because I think he presents such a change of pace for them.
Well, 5 definitely, right? Gilbert, Graham, Greathouse, Faison, Jeffrey. Those 5 definitely. And then Burris is listed. I think they probably, you want to get, if you're making the move with Burris to Boundary, which you obviously are, I think you need to get him reps in this game I guess you could wait till Rice, but I mean, he's been in the program for a couple of years now. You'd like to see him do that. And then after that,
I don't think they're going deeper.
I mean, probably not. Bubba Frazier, you know, he could, if the game
he could.
Is,
He gets brought up too.
Well, you're gonna have to put some distance between yourself and Wisconsin. And I think it's as we get closer to predictions here, I think it's a lower scoring game. So I'm not sure you get to that. But 5 definitely, and I'm sure there's a 6th in there that they could use in a competitive, if it's a competitive game.
Our next question from RV Mitra 12. The Cover 3 podcast, Hope Chip Patterson has a quote, "Wouldn't it be hilarious?" principal pick many weeks during the season. What is your wouldn't it be hilarious pick for a broader week 1 slate of college football? There were many I had in mind. This is RV Mitra. He thought Marshall putting a damper on the beginning of the Matt Campbell era at Penn State, for instance, and of course, for Notre Dame fans, Fresno over SC.
I'll go first if that's all right, because I'm going to have to bounce. I apologize for that. You do have my prediction, and appreciate this nice new hat from our guy, Tom Zwiller. I would say we launched a new weekly feature on USA Today this morning called the Never Too Early, five games with CFP implications. And number five will always try to be one that requires a little more thinking. I have Fresno State against USC as my number five game in those rankings this week. I like Fresno State. I like Matt Entz. I think he's a hell of a ball coach. They're very physical. I think their physicality will give USC some problems. So since there's a false narrative about empty bleachers, if Fresno State wins, we'll know what the damn narrative is. So anyway, you boys have safe travels. I'm always grateful that you let me drag down your podcast with my presence, and I apologize.
Your 8-6 prediction is really weird, Bryce, but I'll explain it to people when you're up here. So that's it.
The problem is you just don't know who the fans are. Fresno is in California, and they also have red.
they're gonna buy out that place, man. It's going to be you guys can claim their red out. Yeah, go ahead, Tim. What's your wouldn't it be hilarious moment?
Or well, I think it was pointed out, and it's hard to disagree with, you know, Clemson at LSU, Clemson rising up and beating LSU with their professional players or guys that can't play for them or what have you. I've never really, I wasn't actually really familiar with the wouldn't it be hilarious principle.
It's a great one.
it really is. I don't necessarily think in those terms ever, but I am very eager to, and this is Sunday, Monday, I believe, Louisville against Ole Miss in Nashville, which I think Louisville's got a chance to be really good this year. And then SMU at Florida State. That doesn't fall into the category of hilarious, but Clemson at LSU, I think, is a pretty easy choice unless USC were to lose to Fresno State, which I don't anticipate that happening.
I think all those are great candidates. I wouldn't need to see Texas Tech lose to Abilene Christian, but if they struggled, I think Texas Tech had – they've got some major villain vibes, and I think, like, comeuppance is what I think may serve Texas Tech well, and I think the rest of college football would really enjoy it. So that would be, I mean, USC is number one, but beyond that, I would like to see some teams struggle. Like, just they have the holy crap, this is happening moment.
Right.
And like, hey, from a Notre Dame point of view, if Northern Illinois went to Iowa and like put a scare into them, we'd be like, yep, see, it's not any fun when it happens to you. So.
Yeah. I always love that when Navy plays a good team and it's like 27-24 in the fourth quarter. I'm like, see, no fun. They have a helmet buried the entire game. But, I mean, LSU is number one for me. USC would be next. You don't want Miami-Stanford if you're a Notre Dame fan. That would not be hilarious. Because
Don't you want Stanford undefeated when they come to Notre Dame?
That's true. Stanford's undefeated after beating, what, Miami and USC coming to Notre Dame? Could be a little different, I suppose. I mean, mine would be, just because the immediate firing would happen, would be East Carolina and Alabama.
That is, that's
27 points. It's not 47 points. It's 27. That's an immediate firing. That's just, I'm not rooting for somebody to be fired, but Alabama did not deserve anything they got last year. And you know what though, if Alabama goes for it and they're behind ECU on fourth down, I bet they get it. And then they will probably.
Well, what about this two for you? Fresno State beats USC, immediate firing, following East Carolina being Alabama, immediate firing. And then the guy got fired at Alabama gets hired at USC.
That's true. See, this is a great weekly game to play. We are going to have to bring this onto our weekly game. All right. Our final question. This is good. Which Bryce is here for this one? This is incredible. And I got it 3 weeks ago. We're saving it. Brokeback Brian. The most mad I've ever been at the podcast quartet was last year after Miami. Because Priester used the word culture to explain why Indy would win. Miami's culture took them to the national title game. O'Malley told us the secondary was the team's strength, and they stunk en route to 0-2. That's true. Bryce said the offensive line was the strength, and they stunk against Miami and in short yardage all season long. And Pete said CJ Carr would be the difference, and he got outplayed by both QBs en route to 0-2. So he says, my question is, why am I going to hate you after week one? I'm sorry, but that's the best question I have received in a
while. Why are we going to hate? Why are you going to hate us after week one? Because you're unhinged? I don't. I mean, all of those things are true. I mean, what can we say? I will say that picking openers is a little bit more difficult than it used to be with the influx of the transfers, etc. And frankly, I mean, who felt great about Miami's culture going into last season? I mean, you know, I mean, prior
nobody,
to that,
that's why Mario Cristobal did a phenomenal job.
Exactly. But we take Brokeback Brian's question with good spirit. And I'm obviously from what I said about Wisconsin earlier, I'm not predicting Wisconsin beating Notre Dame, but I think you do have to respect, you know, what they might be capable, some of the inroads that they might be capable of plowing into with Notre Dame. The whole key, I know we're about to get into predictions. The whole key is, well, not the whole key, but a significant key for Notre Dame's offense is, can you run the football with which some of these other programs, Indiana and the ones that I mentioned previously, you know, weren't able to do against Wisconsin.
While we're going to predictions here, Pete Sampson, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you, of all people, Irish Gambler wanted to join the podcast, and he was asking a question about wide receiver snaps as well, but we handled it. So he said, to sweeten the pot, I assume this means to get in, did you know Joe Burrow threw 60 touchdown passes and LSU scored 95 touchdowns? So, Gambler, your name is now on the podcast because you sweetened the pot. We just didn't work it.
Let's see, LSU, 95 touchdowns. Wisconsin 19 last year.
Yeah. Now that was a team that LSU team did not have a question at boundary receiver.
They did not. They were not worried about their boundary receiver and
or their field receiver, their slot receiver, or the quarterback.
No, all good.
Probably right guard was fine.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, we got right guard worked its way out for that 95 touchdowns as well. All right, we're going to predictions. John Bryce is prediction Notre Dame 34, Wisconsin 10. That is a cover and an under. Pete Sampson.
I like Wisconsin to cover. I think that Notre Dame's offense is kind of a little bit more of a work in progress than maybe some fans would want. I also think it's totally fine that it is. So I'm going Notre Dame 31-13. I think it's a game where the starters pretty much play the whole way. And I'm like maybe the final 2 minutes. Like this isn't – I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of like emptying of the bench. I think the defense will look – very good. I think the offense will have some funkiness to it that's got to work through. I think that, and I also think that's totally fine. So I'll go Notre Dame 31-13.
Big game for Oregon, excuse me, for Wisconsin. They don't play Oregon, Washington, Indiana, or Ohio State. And if you really want to drill, and if you really want to drill down their schedule, they don't even play Northwestern or Michigan. See what I did there. But that's incredible that they miss all those teams. So this is a huge game for them. I just think Notre Dame's defense is way too good. I have a 34-9 prediction under with a Notre Dame cover. And I do think it could be 7-7 or 7-6 at some point in the game for everybody feeling a little angst ridden because, you know, even Al Golden, they you give up the points early, you don't know what's going on, you don't adjust to it yet. But I think Notre Dame 34-9 with a blocked PAT by sixth year senior Jason Onye to throw on a little bit of little carry on top.
Yeah, I think we should get like very specific predictions within the predictions moving forward.
I would be very specific to say to you that Jordan Faison, Jaden Greathouse, and Neas Williams will score the 4 or 5 touchdowns that are in this game.
I've got Faison doing the Lambeau leap first.
Yeah, you had Faison, right? Yeah. Now that you've heard all these things about CJ Carr, I have him doing a Lambeau leap and a.
No, I don't need to see Carr even attempt that. Stay away.
Stay grounded.
Let's have him send Blake Hebert to do the Lambeau leap for him.
Yeah.
Well, the game's on Sunday, but we will, like normal, like a Saturday game, we will have all of our predictions on IrishIllustrated.com on Friday. So I'll reveal my score then, and I'll say I do like a lower scoring game. I think it plays itself to that. I think that, first of all, Wisconsin – You better qualify for a bowl game this year with that schedule. I know people are ripping on Notre Dame's schedule, you know, and it's difficult in the Big Ten, but not when you miss IU, Michigan, Ohio State, Oregon, and who was the other one, Tim? Did you say somebody else?
Washington.
And Washington. Good Lord. So yeah, I was on with Nick Olson from the 24/7 site covering the Badgers, and he, you know, he said they're hopeful of a 7-5 season. I think that's 7-5. I think that's realistic for Wisconsin. I stand by the notion that Wisconsin has the fourth most talent on Notre Dame's schedule this year, behind Miami, BYU, and SMU.
Which is not a ringing endorsement of Notre Dame's schedule that you're.
Well, no, it's not. And it, but, and you know, and again, it's great bringing in a bunch of talent, but you got to pull it all together. And they have seven transfers on the offensive line and seven transfers on the defensive line, where you need bodies. But man, I mean, there's a lot of communication. Tim, you're talking about communication along the defensive line. There's a lot of communication that goes on that is built over time, over years, that they don't have. Yeah. So ultimately, I just think Wisconsin's I have respect for why I have history. I go way back with Barry Alvarez and have always kind of pulled for them. I forgave him for leaving Notre Dame after, you know, after winning a national title, but yeah, I mean, I think Wisconsin will be physical and tough, but I don't think it'll be enough against Notre Dame in a low-scoring game.
Tim Priester will have his highly anticipated prediction on Friday, as he said, as usual. We have Marcus Freeman on Friday, which throws some things off at the website. You may hear from us if there's any updates. Marcus Freeman's Zoom is normally Thursday. We'll have him at noon on, be very brief, I think, at noon on Friday. There'll be more coverage at irishillustrated.com on Saturday because we have a weekend of college football coming. And I would direct all of you that have not read Pete Sampson's story on CJ Carr to The Athletic, because that was a fun read. And as I said, I had a little bit of a feeling you're doing a deep dive on CJ Carr when every question to everybody was about CJ Carr, Pete Sampson. For Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, John Bryce of USA Today, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider. We'll see you at Lambeau Field.